Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety-first L2, accelerating the transition to an on-chain financial system. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the episode, but for now, on with the program. All right, everyone, welcome back to another roundup edition of On the Margin. You've got Quinn, Tyler, and Felix. Fellas, welcome.
Gentlemen.
Top of the morning.
What's up?
Top of the morning. Guys, Emporium, back at it again. Sorry, I missed you lads last week.
How was the wedding, Mike? You tear up the dance floor?
It was great. It was excellent. Yeah. I cut up the dance floor. You know it. No, I didn't. Not at all. I did miss my flight back actually on Sunday, which is the only second time in my entire life that I've done that. So yeah, it was a good wedding. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I was out late.
That's all you need to say.
Like Tyler in Vegas on his 40th birthday.
Oh yeah. What was that? 9:30? 10 p.m.
Yeah.
Well, Tyler, you must be catching a flight to Vegas right after this with that shirt.
Yeah. Someone roasted me in the comments. So he said my shirt last week was I should have had a bucket hat and swimmies. So I wanted to wear this one. So roast me as best as you can this week. The winner gets a prize. Let me know in the comments. Roast me as much as you can.
I feel like, Tyler, you're perpetually dressed for like going to a daytime like Avicii concert in Vegas, like one of those places where you're standing in the pool, kind of going like this daytime, listening to Avicii do something.
Or a six-year-old's birthday party.
Yeah.
It's a fine line between those two things.
Way more likely. Way more likely.
Yeah. All right. Should we get into, maybe just to preface this, the biggest story today is, at least in markets, is a geopolitical story. So there's increasing hostility, or, you know, there's a little bit of debate about how much hostility there really is between Iran and Israel. I'm going to preface this by saying whenever geopolitics comes up on the show that none of us are experts in this. It's extremely difficult to have alpha. I want to caveat that right out of the bat, but it just feels like it's important to talk about it because it's, I think, moving markets today. So obviously there was the pretty highly publicized drone attack from Iran to Israel the previous week. Most of that was mitigated almost entirely, but felt like there was some political impetus on the side of Israel to return fire, so to speak. So there's been a sort of selected strike that happened in Iran overnight last night. So we're recording this on Friday the 19th. And so this happened basically overnight. And I'm just reading the Wall Street Journal takes just like everyone else. It looks like it could have been a lot worse. And Iran, like local media in Iran, is actually playing this down. They're saying there wasn't any casualties, yada, yada, all that stuff. So it looks like the way that this is being interpreted, and I think there's some evidence of this in the markets, which hasn't responded to this overly much, especially oil, that this is actually Israel was trying to thread this needle between needing to respond to Iran without actually doing something that was going to continue to escalate tensions. But what is your guys' sense of all of this? Are things escalating? Is stuff getting out of control? Or are markets telling us that this is going to be relatively confined and it's kind of a facade?
Yeah, I think this has been a really good example of experiencing trading and watching markets through a geopolitical event. I don't really have a prediction on whether it escalates or not, but I think overall, this has been a really good lesson in understanding what happens during these events. Because last night we saw that, you know, Iran or Israel did some sort of attack on Iran. And then within 10 minutes, 15 minutes, we started to see these releases come out from the Iran side saying that, no, this didn't actually really happen. And I don't think a single person could have predicted that to occur. And it really just shines a light on the fact that there's a lot of moving parts in the background, just by the nature of, national security for each of these countries. And that's almost impossible to predict. So when I experience these events, there's a few simple pointers that I keep in mind, which is one, you know, be humble about what we know, because there's a lot happening in the background that we don't know about that can really, you know, move markets once that actually comes out. Generally speaking, paired with that is that it seems that price really often moves in excess of what the actual event is. So that does sometimes set up opportunities for if you're actively trading this. But generally, those are very extreme scenarios. But overall, just to be humble about what's going on. Like you said, Mike, none of us are experts. we can try to react to when things actually happen. But I think overall, this has just been a really good lesson, I think, for a lot of people that, you know, is this actually even a war? Is it just talk, or is it just, you know, symbolic events from both sides? But I think overall, it's just coming at it through humility. That's really important.
The takeaway, this more markets focused, is as you, like, yeah, no idea what's going to happen, is anytime there's a sharp, sudden move that involves a lot of liquidations, but low volume time period. So you think Saturday night was the first time this happened, or, you know, when the big event happened in the market. And then, you know, we had it last night, and both occurrences happened, you know, kind of in between Asia and European hours, and very, very low volume. So these headlines can cause cascades and liquidations and sharp moves. And that's, I think, why you've seen the reversal, because you just should always never trust low volume moves as much as high volume moves. So that's something I would take away.
My only read on this is the VIX is almost inverted again. So your front month VIX is at 1840. 3 month VIX is at 1887. Generally, when, you know, your volatility is bid up in the near term rather than out 3 months, that's usually a sign to me that there is max uncertainty. People don't know what's going on. They're hedging their books. And the drawdown has actually been pretty, I guess, from a volatility perspective, the quants are selling very steadily. It's not like this insane reaction that used to have when there was more actively managed things. This is very CTA driven, where volatility pops, they delever. Volatility pops, they delever. So I don't know. It's been pretty constructive, I'd say. And if you look at like the twos to tens curve, there's really no damage in the fixed income market. There's tight, you know, credit stress is getting a little bit tighter, but that thing's flat, which indicates to me that there's not like this sovereign debt crisis going on. Now, that might not be true if you look at like Asian currencies, which we will probably get into at some point. But I don't know. I think this has been relatively, if I was going to make a prediction, I think the VIX, this is max uncertainty. If it gets worse, I don't know, maybe you have one more flush in there, but this feels like all this protection will wind off here and roll off. So we'll see.
I think just to quickly add something there, if you're a, you know, retail individual that just trades your own book, I think it's useful to just have a thought experiment around, you know, say what institutional folks are doing during this moment, because they're taking actions that might not feel rational to a retail individual, because they have a risk management team to answer to, and they have a value at risk model to answer to, where if uncertainty rises, they just got to cut stuff just to get that back in line. And it's not fully rational when paired to say how you're thinking about this. And that can sometimes provide opportunity where, you know, they just got to get that VAR down and they'll just sell anything to get that down. And that can sometimes provide opportunity. And I think that's, it's a good example, because last night we just saw, you know, I think the SPY futures were almost down 2% at one point, and, you know, we opened up pretty much green.
Yeah. I was surprised to see, when I rolled out of bed this morning, that was the first thing that I saw, is the attack from Israel and Iran. And I was like, oh my God. And I checked the price of Bitcoin. It's up like 5%. So, you know, I got to ask this
because there was a headline that everyone kind of overlooked. It was like Binance sold $1 billion of Bitcoin in the last couple of days. And how much of that was really the weakness in Bitcoin? Because that's a lot of, I don't know what time frame they did it in, but that's kind of a lot of flow. So I was assuming that might be, you know, the majority of this weakness in Bitcoin. Now that that's gone, you know, we're kind of grinding higher into the halving.
Yeah. Honestly, I feel like there's an enormous, everyone always wants price to move based on some news. But Tyler, we used to have these conversations where it was like, you'd call guys in the pit and be like, why is price going high? Oh, more buyers than sellers. Maybe go F yourself, you know? And I feel like that happens so often in crypto where, first of all, Bitcoin's a pretty liquid market at this point, but usually there's something that's moving price, which is just someone selling or someone's buying. And then we try to attach all of these different narratives around it. And I would not be surprised if the weakness was just Binance selling a little bit. And now it's, I don't know if it's going to move higher from here, but I think that's probably what was moving things more than some news headline for the most part.
Yeah, that $1 billion number is more than the cumulative action in the Bitcoin ETFs for the whole month of April, you know, 20 days in. So it's a huge, yeah. where, you know, volumes have come down so much, you know, there's less supply here, but there's also less demand. And so the market's kind of looking for direction. That $1 billion has definitely been impactful on the market.
Yeah.
You know what else is interesting about that is, like, Bitcoin was correlated to tech stocks this week because of the Binance sales. But today, if you look at it, you know, Bitcoin's up 2%. Tech stocks are down 1%. Semis are down 2%. And it's kind of like that, it's dislocating from that correlation today, which, who knows? You know, in the near term, it's really hard to say, like, these things are correlated. But I like to think longer term, Bitcoin emerges as an inflationary hedge. And we're seeing that today. Like, XLE is up 1.5% and Bitcoin's up 1.5%. So now it's correlated to energy. So we'll see if that keeps going. It's something that, like, is bothering me.
Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first layer 2 that is accelerating the transition to the on-chain financial system. Now, I know we're all very excited about tokenization. Larry Fink certainly is. He's on CNBC talking about it all the time. And I know we're all very excited about L2s. Here's the problem, though. If we want L2s to onboard the financial system, there's a lot of stuff that we still need, and Kinto is basically rolling out solutions for that. So one, it features user-owned KYC, which is just table stakes for our regulated friends. And if we want the institutional capital to come in, Kinto offers a really good solution for that. They also have native account abstraction that solves some of the largest problems with onboarding in terms of security and user experience today, which is still very confusing. So if we want to bring more folks onto Ethereum, Kinto is the way to do that. And if you believe in this on-chain financial system and you actually want to get more active in Kinto and become a founding member, you should join their launch program, which is Engine. That's ENGN. You can see a link in the show notes. So if you're a part of that, you can do things like participate in Kinto governance, the launch ceremony, and priority access to product launches on Kinto. You get reduced fees and unique discounts on products launch on Kinto. So overall, if you want to be a part of Kinto and the mission that they have, I would go click the link, join the Engine program, and thank me later.
Yeah.
Do you guys think Bitcoin trades the same way that tech stocks do? It has for the last couple of years, but do you think that continues meaningfully into the future?
I think we still have, yes, short answer, yes. I think, Tyler, what my base and bull optimal case for Bitcoin is what you lay out. But my personal take is that that's still anywhere from 6 to 12, maybe 18, but enough away that it's, because right now I just view Bitcoin as, and crypto generally, is the tip of the spear of liquidity conditions. And it takes a lot less liquidity for stocks to be supported than it does for crypto at this moment. I just think there needs to be a higher level of adoption for it to become that more gold-like, you know, it's just too immature still.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And, you know, you just have to look at last night's price action where gold soared and Bitcoin dumped. It was trading like a classic risk asset. You know, I'm sure Peter Schiff was laughing about that one. But sadly, yeah, it's still trading like a risk asset. You know, that correlation does change over time. Sometimes it trades almost, you know, like basically perfectly positive with NASDAQ. And, you know, sometimes it's almost negatively correlated. So it does change. But, you know, overall, I would say it's generally trading still like a risk asset, and I don't see that really changing anytime soon.
Yeah. You know, as much as I would love Bitcoin to not trade like a risk asset, it makes sense to me that it gets traded like a risky asset, right? It is risky in the grand scheme of assets that exist in the world, right? Like, you could just buy regular old companies or bonds or something like that, and you are probably taking less risk than you are with Bitcoin. That's also why the returns are interesting as well. So
I don't know about bonds.
Maybe not bonds. Yeah.
Well, on this point, can I read this? I think I sent this to you guys on Telegram, but I want to read this from Russell Clark. And he says in one of his latest letters, he said, "Well, why have we focused on the potential supply disruption of the Russia-Ukraine war? We've not focused on the gold demand creating aspects of sanctions. The West basically froze Russian central bank holdings. What is the point of having U.S. treasuries as foreign reserves if you don't know you can use them when you really need them? This is particularly true for China, but will be equally true for any nation in the world that does not 100% agree with U.S. policy." What is true for treasuries is equally true for bunds, gilts, JGBs. So buying fixed income for foreign reserves is now a dead policy. That is, sanctions on Russia did not disrupt Russian gold supply, but it did create a new demand for gold. China has been buying more gold. And so to the point about like reserve assets and why Bitcoin should theoretically fit into this reserve asset relative to bonds, and you're waiting for this moment where like a sovereign like goes, bam, we're buying this for a reserve collateral. Because right now, you just X'd out half your foreign buyers of the treasury market, and now they're going to gold. So you, what competes with that is Bitcoin, in my opinion, but we still haven't seen that emerge.
Tyler, do you feel like there's a lot of irrational complacency? Because I feel like this is something we talked about when Russia first invaded Ukraine and US did what it did. And we're like, oh my God, like every sovereign is going to have to sell their entire treasury books. But, you know, they haven't necessarily done that. It's slowed down. There's a debate about whether China's outright selling their treasuries. They're clearly not net buyers these days. But it feels to me like there's either a lot of complacency or just irrational execution where they basically still have to participate. Then how do you break that?
You mean in terms of treasury demand?
Yeah, in terms of these central banks, you know, there's obviously this new tail risk involved.
I think there's a ton of complacency because these things can't move overnight. We're talking trillions of dollars here. And two, it's, you know, it goes back to the whole, like, what would you expect policymakers to say? Like, if China and Russia and US, like, whatever your action is, like, they're never going to say, oh yeah, we're de-risking our US Treasury portfolio, because then the world would dump bonds and front run them. Or I always think about this too with Bitcoin, is like, why would like an Apple or Amazon or a big corporate or a big sovereign, their incentive is to not let anybody know about what they're doing until the last possible moment that they have to. Like, otherwise you're getting front run, you know, and it's a horrible execution. So like, we won't know about these events until like, if a sovereign or a corporate starts doing it, like Bitcoin's going to start moving like 10 or 15%. And then it's going to be like, what's going on? And you'll find out a month later or something, which is kind of what's gold has been doing a little bit.
So this was, I thought, a really interesting tweet from Vincent Delaward. So what he's looking at here is cumulative flows of treasury bonds, TIPS, and gold ETFs. And this is since 2021, so 3 years. And keep in mind that the reason that he is looking at this time period is because this is when there was the last sub 2% inflation print. And during this period of time, treasuries ETFs took in $290 billion at the same time that TIPS ETFs were basically flat and gold ETFs lost $20 billion. So, you know, to your point about all of this stuff, is there some complacency? I'm sure there absolutely is. Like, is there, by the way, he was making a point about inflation not going back to 2% here, which I think that's actually a pretty interesting debate to have as well. And we can segue into the logic behind this chart. But I don't know, sometimes, you know, I would just put myself in the shoes of someone like whoever is in charge of foreign exchange at the PBOC, and they're sitting on a $1 trillion portfolio of these. Like, really put yourself in that guy's shoes for a second, you know, and be like, would I be buying Bitcoin here? I don't know, man. I don't know. If you're wrong about that, you are in such a world of hurt, right? So I think these things just take, you know, decades to play out. And it's actually pretty logical because, you know, it's easy for us to say, us four guys on this podcast, be like, oh, I would buy Bitcoin in that situation. But like, would you? Yeah, you know, would you really?
Here's another take on that. If you're a sovereign, wouldn't you be, you're probably mining Bitcoin and not letting anyone know you're buying Bitcoin. And here's another thought experiment. If you've been mining Bitcoin as a sovereign to not like signal the market that you've been accumulating Bitcoin, what happens after the halving where your mining rewards go down? Do you end up buying the Bitcoin in the open market as a sovereign? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know, dude. The challenge with mining is just the amount of expertise and infrastructure and time that it would take to accumulate a meaningful position in Bitcoin is extremely long. You'd have to be very forward thinking as a sovereign to start mining your own Bitcoin. But maybe someone correct me. Like, I could be totally wrong about that. Maybe people are doing that. But
I don't know. Word would just get out. It's too big of an operation. People would know about it.
Yeah.
It'd be very difficult to do that covertly.
Yeah. All right. So let me ask you guys, get your perspective on. So I'm actually talking to Vincent later today, but basically when he's looking at this chart, the takeaway that he has, and there's a counter to the takeaway here, which is that this is the market just expecting that inflation is going to go back to 2%. And the rationale here is, if you are a believer long term that inflation is going to be 3-4% or just elevated in general, why would you ever hold US treasuries and just get slowly diluted over time? So basically, one way that you could look at this is to say that you could look at this and say the market just believes that inflation is going to come back down to a reasonable level. And that's why people are still buying bonds or US treasuries at this time. There is another rational explanation as well, which is just to say US treasuries, especially short dated securities, is just how most investors prefer to hold cash. Like, you might as well hold yield bearing cash. And if you want to hedge on inflation, you can do it in some other way outside of this, right? Like, the best way to, you know, play inflation being secularly higher isn't necessarily to just hold tips, right? So we might be confusing things, but what do you guys think about this? There's an increasingly loud chorus of voices that are questioning whether or not we're ever going to get back down to 2%. And I would just be curious how you interpret that chart, like where you guys sit on that line, especially with the history of these last three hot CPI prints.
I feel like that chart's a good representation of the passive investment bid that occurs in markets. Mm. That bid does not end up in tips, really. It definitely does not end up in gold. It ends up in treasuries in the 60-40, basically just, you know, following your flight path to retirement, you increase your bond exposure. So to me, that's just like passive investment in a nutshell in that chart. And I don't know how you really change that flow, but it is there and it's very strong.
I'll tell you how you change the flow. This is what we brought up last week, and I'm going to make this a thing. We've seen the end of the bubble in passive. I'm pretty confident that's what's happening here. And to Vincent's point, is like, today is a perfect example. When you get energy stocks rallying, that's where passive is not there. So what will happen is you'll just get this gap between performance. And I put a chart on my Twitter today. It was like, XLE is up, I think, 15% year to date. The Qs are only up 3. And so as that performance gets wider and wider between inflationary hedging assets and, you know, passive, where people are parked in passive, they'll change the rules. Passive will change the rules, and because they're dragging on performance. And I think that will start happening more and more as this, I guess, like long-term inflation from capital to labor gets entrenched.
I agree. And I think it will have to, because the whole thesis behind 60-40 is you're levered to the growth of the economy and cash flows via the 60, and the 40 is a hedge. When that goes down, your bonds go up. And that, how many consecutive years of that not working do you have to see before you know, like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice. You know, some smart asset manager will start doing this. And to Vincent's broader point, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I'm like, it's globally. Like, that's why, you know, people have pointed out the dollar rising with gold, when in reality, it's normally when rates and dollar are rising, gold's getting hit. And the fact of the matter is, fiat currencies, the yen, the dollar, the DXY, these are all relative fiat measures. And everyone's doing the same thing of liquidity injections, devaluation. And so that becomes a less useful metric over time, comparing, you know, kind of all the dirty shirts in the laundry bin versus, you know, gold, whereas it's kind of out of it. So I think that matters and will continue to matter as the supply dynamics just don't add up to the demand side, or overpower. The demand side doesn't add up to the supply overpower for the next, you know, couple of years.
Mike, just to answer the second half of your question around whether inflation is going to go back to 2%, I think we have to talk about R star and the natural interest rate, because that's the framework that policymakers use. There's an interesting paper I just put up here from the Bank of International Settlements, where they started to analyze the different models.
Felix, can you zoom in a little bit on that?
Yeah,
on that
totally. Paper?
Thanks. Beautiful.
So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to calculate R-star, and you can really debate the validity of a lot of them. But I think just by using this analysis where they took all of them and basically aggregated them and weighted them, their analysis of it since the pandemic has been that the natural rate of interest has been going up ever since then. And basically, when you compare that to just where policy is, real policy rate in the on the X here versus this basically range of the different models, I think it's pretty safe to say that the neutral interest rate has increased. It's really hard to say specifically what that is, but I think that's an important framework to look at the discussion about whether this 2% target is even realistic anymore. And I don't think it is. You know, the next step from there is, how do they basically get to regain credibility as a central bank, the Fed, if they don't even touch that 2%? Or are they just going to try and, you know, tap it on a month over month annualized basis and you know, claim victory and then move the inflation mandate to say 3%? But curious on your guys' thoughts.
I think there's no shot. I mean, the thing to remember here is the Fed's and the Treasury's covert yield curve control. I harp on this a lot, but October 2022, when global fiscal leaders intervened on the dollar and interest rates to add liquidity to save the gilt, March 23 banking crisis, October 23 U.S. sovereign debt crisis. All three scenarios, the liquidity was made possible by the fact that inflation was declining, and 2022 and throughout 2023. We're now in a situation where liquidity is tightening, rates are going up, commodities, inflation proxies are going up, financial conditions are tightening, but how can monetary and fiscal leaders respond when inflation is now actually going up again? It's not coming down, and it's nominally at the levels of late 22, early 23. So that whole like rock and hard place idea of how do we stimulate, save the economy, but you know, still add liquidity and not spark inflation, that is coming ever closer. So I think you get into this precarious position where you can't go full bore liquidity injection like they did in March of last year, which they can, but then that's when you really let inflation out of the bag again. And to the credibility point, I think like it's kind of shot already. Like it's not yet, maybe, but like everyone's seen the writing on the wall, or the people, the macro people in the market anyways.
Well, I think the spending, you know, it's less about the Fed now, and the spending is just coming from the fiscal side.
Yes.
Yeah. So, right. You know, that's making up for all this stuff. So,
but it's not going to end until it absolutely has to end. And to me, that's inflation above 5. Like, and it's definitely not going to end in 24 before an election. So I think that's the main point, is like this monetization will have to come from somewhere. Yes, you have $400 billion left in the RRP. Maybe that's good for 3 or 4 months. But once that's drained, it's dollar for dollar debt issuance for liquidity drainage. And that's when you really, I think, have to see a change in Fed policy.
But Yellen also had, you know, tax day, and now the TGA, Treasury General Account, should skyrocket back up, which she can kind of press the gas on the fiscal side there too.
Yeah, so. I was looking, it's at 950 now, where their target 750. I know there's some negative bill issuance coming up, which will probably neutralize that, but I think overall you're right that, you know, there's that lever to play with as well.
Yeah, Felix, you brought up,
funny how it just works out so well, you know.
I know.
Felix said the date, you know, this is really important. I think it was May 5th is the Treasury.
May 1st, actually.
May 1st. Yeah.
I forgot you Americans go, what is it, month, day, year, or day, month, whatever it is. Yeah. 5-1.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So that's apparently we wear our shoes in our houses too, apparently. Sounds like some Canadian on American beef here, Felix.
Hello, listeners of On the Margin. I've got good news for those of you who are in the crypto scene. Blockworks is bringing back Permissionless. We're going to be doing Permissionless 3, and this year we are heading west. So we're moving that out to Salt Lake City. That's going to be October 9th through 11th this year. We've got a phenomenal lineup of speakers for you. So we've got Balaji headlining. We've got Sriram, Munib,
Matt Hogan of Bitwise, Jan Van Eck. This one's going to be a blast, guys. And I saw many of you out in London for DAS this year, and I hope to see you out in Salt Lake for Permissionless. And because y'all are such faithful listeners, we've got, if you use code MARGIN10, you're going to get 10% off your tickets. Appreciate you all. Hope to see you out there. I've got a question for you guys. So I noticed, I don't know if you guys saw this tweet from Larry McDonald, but he was mentioning that back in the 1970s, during that inflationary crisis, interest payments were actually counted in inflation. And since we've done a whole bunch of revisions, there's actually been a whole bunch of different revisions in terms of how we calculate CPI today. So there's this concept of owner's equivalent rent, which is, again, a hypothetical sort of construct. And we also just don't count interest payments. And there's some good reasons for doing that. But he went back and said, hey, if we were calculating, you know, you probably heard this sentiment, and maybe listeners of the podcast also felt this way. When we were getting 9% inflation, it didn't feel like 9%. It felt like way, way more than that. And maybe that's just because I live in New York, but like rent prices where I am, it felt like it went up way more than the 10 or whatever percent was being ascribed to it. It went up like 30, 40, 50%. And so, you know, this one explanation was just that if you calculate inflation the way that it was being calculated in the 70s, it would have come out more towards between 18 and 20%. So here's one lever that is available to policymakers as well. It would be tough to do this in an environment where inflation was rising, but they could just do that exact same thing and say, hey, we just did a study and it turns out we've been calculating inflation all wrong. And if you rejig it around, you can actually see we're really close to 2% inflation here. You know, they could just do that. And if I were unilaterally in charge and I was extremely motivated towards trying to, you know, inflate covertly, that would be one of the levers that I would pull. I would just redefine the rules of the game.
They do that every year, don't they? They change the basket every year, and it's kind of that process.
Yeah.
To your point, the auto insurance going up was at 20%. They can just say X autos. No one even owns an auto anymore. You know,
well, every month it's X something. So it's X auto, X healthcare, X dog food, X, you know, gasoline. And then you're at this like super, super, super core, and it's just like pizza. And you're like, yeah, okay, great.
But inflation is zero.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? And it's like hilarious.
I want to ask you this. You see these, I see a lot of the social media stuff in Canada, and they're like flipping out on the inflation there. And maybe it's just, you know, I'm in the wrong rabbit holes. But I will say this, the government has largely been lying to us on a lot of things, and especially for millennials, where they're hitting like this age and people are flipping out because they're like, I'm too poor to start having children. I'm too poor to have this. And the inflation for food is getting aggressive. Is that real in Canada, or is that just something rabbit hole I'm down in social media?
It sounds like when I'm on True Social, it's all I see.
Rumble.
No, it's true. There's a lot of frustration here right now. You know, to understand political cycles in Canada, basically we go through these 8-year cycles where it goes from the Liberal Party, which is the Democrats over there, or the Conservatives, which are the Republicans. And basically we just change regimes every 8 years. And then we get sick of that guy and we flip to the other side. And so we're at the end of that 8-year journey. And, you know, back in, what was it, 2016, when Justin Trudeau was first elected, there was, you know, he made weed legal. So that was super cool for a lot of young people. But you fast forward now to 2024 and, oh crap, the entire Generation Z can't even afford to live or buy a house or see any sort of viable future. So we've seen this complete shift where, you know, Generation Z is extremely conservative. And there's an election coming up. So there's a few factors at play that are accentuating it. But overall, there's a lot of frustration. But, you know, part of that is for sure that just that we're at the end of the regime, and it's time to flip to the other side. But a lot of that is driven by unaffordability, especially in real estate. Like, there's an interesting chart where you just look at like income growth versus housing prices in the US and Canada. And income growth has tracked so much, like quite a bit closer to housing prices in the US, but in Canada, the dispersion is just off the charts. So that's really charging a lot of this right now.
To your point, I don't know if you guys feel this, and not to get too political, but I think that shift to conservatism is kind of interesting in the younger generations, because I've seen a lot of this on social media too, but like women who are now working, you know, maybe have a kid or two kids, they're becoming way more conservative. Historically, they're massively liberal because it's really hard when you're pregnant, you know, after you have the child, you have to get right back into the workforce. And they're all like, what is the point of this? Like, I'm sitting in a cubicle working, and I don't know if that's just because it's my age contingent of all having children, but it feels like the women that were formerly super liberal are now like, wait, how do we make this function? Like, I can't keep up with having a family, being a mom, working. And there seems to be some sort of like breaking point there. Are you guys feeling that at all?
So I
can't go down this rabbit hole though on this show.
We can X this out, but
yeah,
I agree too heavily.
Yeah, I agree. I agree as well. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but we had our CTO is German, and he was in town this week for an on-site, and we were talking about Germany versus the US, you know, pros and cons basically. And he was describing, cause he was in California for a while. He's like, dude, the homeless thing there is just crazy. And we've just solved that problem in Germany. I was like, what do you mean by that? And you know, he described, well, when you're homeless in Germany, you go through some sort of mental illness, the government gives you a home and they provide your sick care. And of course, my red-blooded American self was like, our tax dollars? I was like, well, that's why you guys pay all these taxes. And he was like, our tax rates are the same. I looked it up. They're the same. I really was scratching my head. I was like, what the hell? And, you know, you've probably seen these memes around, the drone flights going on in Israel versus Iran. And the subtext is like one side firing at another. It's like my tax dollars, somehow also my tax dollars. And it's like, yeah, this is where the tax dollars are going. So yep. It is. Sorry. Go, Quinn.
No, I was going to tie that with, we were just talking about wages. And I've been harping on this point, but I'm not that I don't really care about politics only in the sense that it affects markets. Either. And people get their undies in a bundle when I point this out. But the amount of border crossings on the southern border in the last 3 years under Biden, astronomically above the previous 20-year average. But that number in 3 years is equal to the total number of unemployed workers in the labor force in the U.S. And the byproduct of this is the biggest spread between high-income wage growth and low-income wage growth in the last number of years, because Powell keeps pointing about the immigration thing that's adding supply to the labor market and lowering wage growth, and pointing to that as a reason for inflation coming down. But the problem with that is it's only hurting the lower class, which is the bulk of the population in the U.S., and they're not seeing any wage growth. They're seeing their prices go up, but no wage growth because there's this huge supply of uneducated workers coming in, and the high wage growth is stickier and higher. So these are massive political, things that you don't hear talk about statistically, but they're the reasons that these populist and these other narratives take shape, because there's actually real problems brewing under the hood for the classes of people. And you don't hear that in these large blue population centers across the U.S. where they're mainly college educated, mainly high income earners. But you venture out and realize, there's actually a problem that creates structural problems for the economy.
And just because I don't want to wade like super into the realm of politics here, what I would also say is one frustration that I have as well is that whenever there's an issue like this that impacts some group of people, immediately sides rush to try to get it to fit their narrative, and they explain why it's all good or all bad. And the reality can just be much more nuanced than that, that there are pros and cons and one group of people benefits slightly more. And yeah, but that just doesn't make for a great news headline, right? Like if you were to read the news headline of a more liberal focused media outlet, it would be like, look at all this good that we're doing, helping people across the board. And by the way, it's driving prices down, low cost labor. And then you could see the same headline from Fox News, and it's like, hey, we're letting in all these goddamn immigrants. And, it's pros and cons. Different groups of people get affected. And
Mike, this is why people come to On the Margin to get both.
That's right, baby. Sure. Yeah, we talk about things on the margin or on the margin.
It's stupid. Right, like the answer is you need the high, you know, because the don't let anybody in means you're leaving out so many smart people that want to come and build their lives here, and then you need more balance on the other side, so you don't just flood the lower income job supply and hurt people. Like,
why don't they just put us in charge, guys? Why don't they just put us in charge? No one asks our opinions on any of these things.
You get some dilettantes in charge.
To that point, demographically, like, how many of your friends do you know who know a legislator and our age group? Zero.
None.
How old was JFK when he was like running for office? How old was Biden when he started running for office? Like, this is what's crazy, is the gerontocracy. And none of these problems that they're solving, they have no idea what social media is or what it's doing. It's just completely lost, which is partly why like everyone's so bullish Bitcoin, I think, is because they're like, this is the release valve for a lot of the social issues too that just keep plaguing us. But you need the sovereign, you need some sovereigns to believe for that correlation to switch. And then you have the new institutions that get built and the old ones have to adjust their rules, right?
Yeah. It's like,
fourth turning, baby.
Fourth turning. All right. Let's talk about Bitcoin a little bit, because we are less than 12 hours out, I believe, from the halving. So happy halving day to everyone. And for folks who've been following or are familiar with Bitcoin, just bear with me here. I'll give a slight description of it. But the halving is the halving of the Bitcoin supply schedule. So, you know, Bitcoin, the way that there's something called the block reward, where miners get paid some amount for basically mining the successful block. And every 4 years, the amount that miners are getting compensated gets cut in half. Now, there's two revenue streams for miners. There's the block reward, and then there are also transaction fees, which have been going up for the first time in basically 5 years. And that's thanks to ordinals and potentially Bitcoin L2s and things like that. But the block reward is extremely important because it directly translates to the equilibrium that gets set in between miners buying and selling Bitcoin. And that's why it tends to, especially mechanically, when Bitcoin was a much larger part of the market and issuance was much larger in the early days, it was a massive driver for these sort of 4 year cycles for Bitcoin. I think today you could make a really strong argument that at least mechanically it's less important, right? There's more supply coming in from the Bitcoin ETFs than the supply reduction of the halving by a large number. But I would also say that the psychological impact of the halving, right, is probably still as important as it's ever been. And one of the differences in this halving cycle versus previous halving cycles is, you know, when the halving happened, even back in the last one was 2020, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Fidelity, they weren't, you know, sending out memos to their clients that the halving is coming up and price is probably going to go up, and lots of people are looking at the chart that we're looking at right now. By the way, if you're following along via video, you can see typically how Bitcoin prices performed following previous halvings. So, yeah, what do you guys think? Is the halving still going to be a big driver of price here? Is it priced in? Is it not priced in? What's our collective take?
Quinn,
I want to hear you guys first. I'm going last here.
You go, Tyler.
I was just going to say, I feel like the fact that we held 60K is a really reassuring thing. It's been in this channel, and I think it's not priced in yet, personally. There's so much – everyone's talking about the Bitcoin ETF flow kind of stopping here. I think when people start realizing what the dearth of supply really is, and any incremental dollar that goes in has a convex move here – they'll probably be like, wow, this is, you know, the thesis will come, the awareness will grow, and we'll take off from there. But I don't know. Quinn seems
what to time be- horizon does it get priced in, or more priced in than today?
Next 2 to 3 months. I think we just kind of been in this channel for now, and everyone's getting overly bearish at the lows and overly bullish at the highs. We need to break out.
Yeah. I think personally, crypto's plagued by an overfocus on supply and a lack of focus on demand. And I always really appreciate Jurrien Timmer's approach because he's created some great demand analysis models. And it's really funny. Like, you even look at how this, you know, it's because we started with Bitcoin and this idea of a steady fixed monetary supply and issuance curve, that it's even trickled down into altcoins where we all start caring about fully diluted values and stuff like that and supply. But I think there's just a huge lack of focus on demand. So for me, especially now that we're getting this like law of diminishing returns in terms of these halvings, like, yeah, this is cool and all to have a decrease in supply, but I'm focused on demand. So, you know, I'm over here looking at, you know, what's the liquidity cycle happening and what's driving that demand. So for me, it's like, it's cool, but I think there's too much of a focus on supply and not enough on demand personally.
Yeah, that's totally true. I mean, if people cared, if the halving was such a big deal, and it was, and people thought that, then the last 5 days of ETF outflows wouldn't have sent the price down, you know, numbers of percent that it has, right? Like, I think it might be the longest stretch of outflows we've ever had on the ETFs. Granted, they haven't been massive, but they've been there, and we've also seen them start to come from some of the majors like BitB, ArcB. I don't know if FBTC had. Yeah, FPT. No, they haven't had one. But yeah, it's. I think what if Bitcoin's price goes up in the next 3 months, people will ascribe, you know, oh, this is the halving again, just delayed. So my number one conviction is that no matter what happens to the Bitcoin price over the next 6 months, people will point to a previous cycle analogy, and it might be very far fetched. But I don't think it's a big deal here, and I actually tend to lean sell the news. I felt really good about sell the news at 70K. Feel less good about selling the news at 60K. But, you know, I think that range that you mentioned, Tyler, actually ultimately breaks down before it goes back up.
See?
Higher. Higher, baby. Quinn is much better than me at calling short-term price action. I just think, you know, just don't overthink this one. I think that that's... it's still meaningful. I think the psychological impact of this is much more meaningful than the supply and demand. Like, Felix, preaching to the choir. I think this whole industry is, it's part of the whole narrative of Bitcoin, right? 21 million hard cap, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of these investment arguments end up getting focused on supply. But you know, this is just one of those things that just recatalyzes attention. People start saying, I've seen this movie before. We are not going to be the only one that looked at those charts. People are going to start saying, "Yeah, the risk reward here feels good." I just think this ends up. I have no opinion if that happens in 1 month or 2 months, or if we go lower before we go higher. But this just feels like I don't think too hard about it. And yeah,
I got to add my macro take here is if you look at the dollar, right? It's been pervasively strong. If you look at any Asian currency dollars, like the Korean won. Bumped up to against 1400, they get defended. The Vietnamese dong, which is Quinn's favorite, is their finance minister said they're going to defend it. The yen, you know, we get the BOJ meeting next week. We're going to get defended. The BOJ said that they're going to tighten, right? And or to basically like not let the yen go completely out of control. So just from a macro perspective, the dollar's been insanely strong. You've had like an Asian currency kind of crisis. It just needs to like calm down there, and then we get a sell-off in the dollar. These other Asian currencies strengthen. And I think that will correlate with the halving narrative. Mm-hmm.
Felix,
every time Vietnam has to prop up the dong, they call you, right, Tyler?
Yeah, 100%. How many dog jokes can we make?
Glad this is such a mature panel here.
It's the Guys Emporium on a Friday afternoon.
Guys Emporium. Oh, man.
Brought up this chart here, the DXY, because this week we saw, you know, last week we were talking about the yen breaking out above that key intervention level. And then a few days ago, we saw this messaging start to come out from world leaders start to talk about making sure that Asian currencies, which have been really weakening lately, basically get protected somewhat against the strength of the US dollar. And a lot of this has been driven just because of how economically strong the US has been lately, which is just creating these huge interest rate differentials because pretty much every other economy is looking to cut. Meanwhile, the Fed is now talking about just holding steady. So that just has this really U.S. dollar strengthening impact. So what I did was just, you know, going back to these different cycle peaks in the DXY, going as far back as the 80s with the Plaza Accord, it really seems like a lot of these topping formations in the U.S. dollar occur when, you know, basically the head honchos, the big dogs get together and start talking about defending or weakening certain currencies. And just wanted to hear your guys' thoughts around this. Like, we had this headline. Is this the cycle recent peak in the DXY? Do you think you guys go higher?
I think my gut tells me there's more pain. It was kind of a weak headline. It was like, you know, we're watching it and paying close attention. The problem that I see is like Yellen has a demand issue for her bonds, and you know we know yields are continuing to go up because of that strong inflation, other things too, but supply is definitely a contributing factor, and these currencies are falling off a cliff versus the dollar and need support, and those are two competing interests. In the past, you know, Yellen's calls to China or Japan to buy her bonds would be fine, but that would imply weakening their local currencies, which they're trying to do the exact opposite. So this is an interesting moment where ultimately the dollar has to weaken. That's bad for domestic U.S. priorities of getting inflation down. That's very inflationary. And I think there's a lot more competing incentives than we've seen in the past. And I see a number of months before it ultimately gets resolved, because I think Yellen taps the RRP to zero and some other things to help liquidity. And it's this continued stopgap approach from the Asian central banks until then. But it does feel near term, maybe we're overbought on the dollar and things, but I think ultimately we still need to see a little bit more pain across the board before there's actual action.
Yeah. I think that we had already been done. You don't want your allies like, you know, Korea and Japan for the US. Now the Nikkei is selling off with the weakness in the yen. So I think at some point markets are so centralized now, and the vol controllers probably have to do some behind the scenes like managing of the currencies, because you don't want the yen selling off, Nikkei selling off, and Japanese bonds selling off. Like, that is the worst combo for the Japanese. And they're supposed to be your primary exporter and take the place of this, of China in this new allied system. So I don't think they can, at this point, if they let it go, that's pretty bad. Like, then we're in a whole new world.
This is my point earlier, though, around knowing the difference in environment, between October 2022, when they pumped liquidity and crushed the dollar in U.S. yields, they March 23 and October 23, the central bank and Fed here in the U.S. didn't have to care about the powerful the impact of their actions, because inflation was declining, and now inflation is moving the other direction. If Yellen and Powell have to be very aware that if they come in to weaken the dollar here to support those Asian currencies, it creates a big problem domestically with inflation. Commodities would be bid, right? Like, strengthening Asian currencies, they can buy more commodities, weakening dollar, that correlation returns for higher oil. I think that's the real problem on the hands. I don't know how it gets resolved, but that's what I see. Is not a limited factor.
I guess, who's to say that, like, maybe a weak dollar could be correlated with commodities going down? Like, it historically, yes, I know what you're saying, where like the dollar's gone up and inflation's gone up together. So maybe the reverse is true.
Because we're a net exporter of energy, in my opinion, versus Japan and Europe are massive net importers. Yeah. So I think depending on the reason the dollar's going down, I think you could be right. But in this case, the dollar would be going down because of artificial liquidity injection in the face of a very strong economy.
I like that.
And then we trade places with Japan. Japan's inflation problem is going up. The economy is strong. And their currency is saying our central bank is not tight enough, right? The currency, you save your bond market or save your currency. And in the US, we would have to start sacrificing the currency a little more. It's interesting. I think that's where things come to a head in the next few months. And particularly that's why I think, I don't think it's gung ho. We're back to loose liquidity. I think we need a bigger event to happen.
Let me ask you guys something. Just we were looking at those Bitcoin charts. The price appreciation of Bitcoin and crypto overall over time has these. There's a pretty empirical pattern to it, and it's actually remarkable. I would be in the camp that what's going on with Bitcoin and crypto right now is just a continuation of previous trends. It's actually been pretty remarkable how consistent most of those patterns have been. How do you reconcile that macro obviously matters and has a large impact with the fact that crypto price action has been remarkably consistent now over an extremely extended period of time across very different macro conditions? Like, how do you just square those two circles? Or how do you square that circle, if you know what I mean?
I'm really interested to see if Plan B's stuff plays out this cycle. And that would show me that the stock to flow ratio really matters more than the macro over the next like 3 to 4 months. But I'm a big believer that macro is the ultimate, you know, equalizer in a lot of this stuff. And if you get credit problems, if you get, you know, geopolitical angst, that outweighs any stock to flow type stuff for now.
I think what we're getting at here is this debate of supply and demand. You can basically plot the upward trend line of Bitcoin on increasing demand over a long structural, you know, multi-year horizon and decreasing inflation. And that kind of creates this long-term trend line that looks a little more linear that, you know, we kind of come back to, or maybe it's a little log shape. And then these extrapolate, you know, the movements way above and way below that line are macro or idiosyncratic crypto FTX type, you know, crypto Lehman moments. But the macro is certainly in short time horizons can be very impactful. I kind of just say like macro matters for 1 or 2 months every 6 months, and then it doesn't matter. And then you kind of continue on. And I think it's kind of the same for stocks too, right? There's this upward drift. Companies are growing, cash flows are growing. There's inflation, nominally priced assets go up. But then for these pockets of, you know, illiquidity or other macro risk events, you need to be paying attention and not get caught.
I personally think that the biggest driver of price is, you know, either call it the refinancing cycle, the liquidity cycle, the, you know, interest payment refinancing cycle. But overall, I think it leads to this idea, you know, to your question, Mike, I think what's primarily driven Bitcoin over the years through these cycles is still that. But I think the difference, the distinction is that over the last year and a half, people have gotten wrong what's been driving price. I think it does actually quite nicely align with that cycle of refinancing. And the reason so many people have gotten it so wrong, I don't know if you guys caught Jack Farley's interview with George Robertson and Michael Howell of Cross Border that came out yesterday, but you know, they've both been really right on being bullish, but for different reasons. But the one thing that they both agreed on is that there's some warpness to the long end of the yield curve. And that's been catching a lot of people offside over the last year and a half. And that's why we've been seeing this inverted, you know, 210 yield curve. That's saying, oh, there's a recession coming. But, you know, there's a lot behind the mechanics of why it's warped. But basically the distinction is that the long end is artificially low, which is creating that inverted yield curve that got so many people wrong. And the implications of that is that we've actually been pretty loose from a liquidity perspective over the last year and a half. And the Fed really hasn't actually done much tightening because we're barely even at neutral. So within that realm where it's really hard to prove this out, because the long end, you know, the 10-year yield is the base, the foundation of pretty much every other asset in the world. But if that is warped through, you know, maybe it was QE that artificially suppressed it. But I think that that refinancing cycle has been occurring over the last year and a half, and we're partway in through it. But because of those warpness, it's been making people think we're in this super tight regime when we actually haven't been. So I think it still aligns with what Bitcoin has been doing personally.
I agree completely with that. And I came at that same conclusion last July, completely different than Howell approaches it. And I also have to give a shout out to Jack. I mean, I don't like listening to every podcast that every person puts, like, I don't listen to any religiously because I think it makes groupthink and then your brain just turns into that podcast host. But the guy just is banger after banger episode. And it's like, fuck, I don't want to listen to every one of these, but they're all so like good that I have to. He's crazy.
You know, who hired Jack to his first job out of college? You know,
who put you onto that? Who put you onto that?
Yeah.
This guy. All right. I don't know if we could go like 5 minutes over here. I want to change tax here. And actually I was listening to this like BG Squared, this like new Bill Gurley podcast. And they started out with this pretty interesting debate on the number of public companies in the US and the IPO market in general. And if you look at the number of, since the 1990s, the number of public companies in the US is down drastically from something like over 8,000 to, I think today it's around 3,500, something like that. And obviously the reason for this is just because there's so much more private funding that's available. But we're at the point now where even authorities like the SEC don't want to see this happening because the logic is, yeah, but there's a need for US retail investors to try to get exposure to the same amount of returns, right, that private market investors have available to them. And with this huge oversupply of capital for private markets has basically meant that especially like US-based VCs, but also sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, they've largely reaped the benefits of a lot of the value creation that's happening over in US company land. And obviously also there's almost a national security or national strategic interest to have like deep sort of liquid capital markets over here in the US that are public. And I would be curious to get your guys' thoughts on this because, you know, not to put my crypto hat on here, but I think there's a weird intersection here between what's going on with tokens over here in the US as well, giving people exposure. And basically tokens are an experiment in just giving extremely early stage like public or liquidity to opening it up to the public. And I'd just be curious what you guys think about, you know, companies staying private longer. You know, is that bad for US investors because they don't get access to so many of those gains? Like, what do you guys think about this whole debate? I thought they were hitting on something kind of interesting there.
My favorite part about this debate is that I saw a video of Ken Griffin, you know, crypto hates Gensler. And I saw a video of Ken Griffin berating Gensler on this topic. Obviously his interests are as many publicly traded stocks as possible to make as much money as possible. But
right.
I do think the advantage of the US over Europe, over Asia countries, you know, is our capital markets efficiency. If you're a smart entrepreneur who has a bright idea and people will back you, you get funding and you can go, you know, innovate on that idea. And I think that closing off, you know, that's one side of it, which would be the supply side. And then the demand side, like you mentioned, is, you know, we're continually favoring the accredited investor over, you know, the retail smaller investor and basically saying you're not smart enough to invest in these things. You know, you don't have enough money to invest. And that alone, you know, we gotta get to a point of equality of opportunity versus equality of outcome. And I think it's shifting that other way. As far as the regulation, I don't know too much.
I'm going to get a little existential on this topic, but you know, generally how we invest at Corriente is you try to find problems with access and, you know, you buy things that are hard to buy. If you can buy assets that are hard to buy, then that means there's more capital when it becomes easier to buy to come in and push the value of those things up, right? And that's the basic premise of investing in general. Yet we've kind of perverted it in the public markets to be like, oh, what's the PE ratio? What's this? You know, what's the cost of capital? You know, but at the end of the day, it's like you buy things before other people can buy them. And like the private markets is where the best alpha is because it's illiquid and it's hard to buy. There's these rules, right? And so I don't know. I think the natural evolution is the alpha where it's hard to buy will keep going up and up and up until they break down that accredited investor basket. And that's, but I think that's partly what you're saying, Mike, is there's not rules for tokenization, and maybe crypto becomes that, you know, that avenue where retail investors can get access to certain ideas if the crypto ecosystem grows large enough.
That's the stupid thing is the private's becoming so big, then you're getting these Fidelity and Charles Schwab and Templeton vehicles that are private. They're vehicles for normal people into private companies. Like, and it's because the regulations are so messed up that it just this bubble, this pocket, and then they're doing the same thing anyways, but just not in the open, not in as transparent, as liquid. It's a classic. Like
I'm going to try and take the other side here for once so that we're not just an echo chamber, which is great. Nice. But I personally feel that, you know, specifically looking at traditional finance, I think a lot of the issues lie with just this experiment that we take to the extreme of like stock-based compensation, warrants, you know, quarterly earnings where companies have to, you know, just juice everything to be able to beat analyst expectations. And that's creating so much short-termism in these companies that you compare that with like a good venture capital firm that is funding and helping these founders actually grow in a more long-term mindset. Like that to me is a lot more appealing to stay within that realm, because if I go public, then I'm going to have to deal with beating analyst expectations every quarter. Then I'm going to have to start doing weird accounting trickery just to, you know, beat these estimates. And then I've totally lost the 10-year vision. You know, so that, you know, squaring that with what's happening in crypto these days, there's this big movement towards basically allowing access to private rounds earlier. But then, you know, you look at the average crypto investor and they're the same people that just want that quick juice of a quarterly earnings pump. But for crypto coins, they don't care about the project versus these really solid, you know, venture firms like Framework that I know is always on the Bell Curve podcast. Like they're actually there working with the founders and actually thinking about the vision versus the other folks. Obviously, there's some nefarious venture capital firms that are just going to want a quick exit liquidity event. But overall, you know, it's when you go public or when you get further out to those regular individuals, it becomes more short-termistic versus the long-term mindset of others.
Yeah. So I was listening to this podcast and very intelligent guy, obviously Brad Gerstner was, you know, describing, you know, it's these, cause there's a huge valuation gap in between privates and public as well. Right. That's the other part of this where, and you can debate how that's going to play out long-term. Maybe this is just a cycle that a bunch of these private investors that are bidding up crazy valuations just need to take a bath. And then naturally some amount of capital leaves, but like that's another huge dynamic at play here where there's this, you know, public and private market valuations don't move in lockstep. There could be gaps for a long period of time. And one of the challenges right now is that all of these VCs gave all of these private companies such high marks in 2021 that no one wants to take their medicine and go public because they're going to have to get re-rated. And Brad Gerstner was Brad Gerstner is great. I love this show. Clearly I'm a listener, but you know, he was like, these boards just need to have some courage. And these leaders just need to have courage to go public. And I was like, what are you talking about, dude? Like, imagine just as the CEO of a company being like, I know we're about to get re-rated. All your options are about to get wiped out, but just have some courage here. that just doesn't make any sense. And that's not a logical argument that's going to fly.
The problem is different in the two worlds too. Cause on crypto, I side with you, Felix, and the problem is like gotten a little one-sided on tokens because you have it just compounds where everyone launches a token, which the token is the product, and they actually launch this liquidity event pre product market fit and cash out. And then the teams quit after a year and there's no follow through. And that's pretty much why I think innovation at the application layer is really, struggled and lagged in crypto because no one has the incentive to stick it through once they've had a liquidity event before their product is even live. And so I think there's a middle ground between the two, which that short-termism can get really bad in tokens, having too easy access to that liquidity. Whereas you know, needing to bring some of the privates probably to the markets.
But even on tokens, like now they at least have vesting schedules and stuff like that. So it's, they do, like a lot of them have like 4-year vesting schedules, similar with equity. So that's just going to get solved, I think. But I do think there's a massive cycle.
Yeah, the high FTV slaughtered basically.
Gosh. Yeah. I mean, you can't blame people for just going in meme coins when you just got those FTV slaughterhouses. It's quite rational, I think.
Oh my God. Yeah. There's something WorldCoin, which is now World Chain. It went up to like 115 billion FTV, something like that. I was looking at Uber. Uber's like $140 billion company. And this thing called WorldCoin is trading at the same theoretical value. I mean, that is just insanity. So, anyway, interesting debate, something to keep an eye on. But all right, fellas, I think we've got to wind down here. Another good meeting of the guys Emporium. I'll see you, fellas, next week.
Have a good weekend. Thanks, everybody. Cheers, guys.